The following podcast is a part of RadioMisfits.com.
Welcome to Misfits Making It. We're oddballs and we're doing cool stuff. I'm your host, Lauren Lojudice. This is the podcast version of the comedy shows I host around New York City and the road, the Misfit Variety Show, and all the shows at the Capiche Club Misfit Comedy Space down in Little Italy. Well, how's it going? What's up in your Misfit world? I've been clowned in a clown hole. I did the pig iron 3-week mask clown intensive thing, and it is the most clowning I've ever done at one time. At some days, it was as much as 10 hours per day. I never knew you could clown for that long. And all meanwhile, I'm like, I definitely don't have time for this. Like, I used to, like, you know, do a little clown workshop. But, you know, I've always, like, I'm a stand-up. So people ask me, like, why do I do clown? And that's because it's, like, almost like a colonic. It just, like, cleans you out. It makes you more present. It gets out the fear. I mean, they put you in the situation, the worst situations, and you have to get yourself out of them by being present and open and vulnerable. Damn, it's hard. And I feel like I've been going, I'd say for the last few years, I've been going, finding myself in a clown workshop, like, every, like, 6 to 8 months. I think I'm good for a hot minute. Maybe it's like an annual, like, almost like a retreat in my mind, like an annual, just like tune up. We'll see. I'm not sure. I don't know where this is going in terms of, like, melding the clown presence with stand up. I have no idea, but I'm excited just to, like, get out there and, like, see what's up. So before we go into our interview today with author, book coach, and producer Georgia Clark, hey, reminder, please rate and review the podcast. Social proof is super important for misfits because misfits trust other misfits to know what's good. Also, you can sign up for updates. I send them every month and you can get them at laurenlogie.com, or you could sponsor a podcast. We make it accessible for individuals or small companies to do so. If you go to laurenlogie.com, click on listen and podcast and contact us there. So today we're interviewing author and book coach Georgia Clark. Georgia Clark is the author of Funny, Sexy, Romantic Comedies. She also founded and hosts the popular storytelling series Generation Women. She also mentors writers and works as a book coach and an editor. And she has a monthly newsletter called Heartbeat. I'm so obsessed with how she incorporates different pursuits and puts them together to create this very vibrant, creative, prolific career. And I think you're going to love to hear this too. Obviously, in the creative world, like, you can't, like, copy the way someone did something, but people are certainly inspirations, and we can take that inspiration to create our own way. And Georgia Clark has done just that. So let's get to that interview with Georgia Clark. Welcome, Georgia Clark, to Misfits Making It.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Well, what I love about you is I actually learned about you. Well, first of all, I learned about you from my friend Carolyn Kosigulik. She was on your show.
Yes.
And that's when I started. I was looking around for people who I thought had really cool stories for this podcast. And then I, you know, went through a wormhole of, like, looking up the show, looking up you. And what I just saw, it was so cool, was that you've lived a life. You've done a lot of things and you embrace that.
Yes, I have.
Was that always, was that always something you rolled with? Like, just about, like, hey, I've done things, here I am. Or did it take you a while to get there?
Well, thanks so much for having me on the show. I'm really excited to connect with you and talk about, you know, being a misfit who's quote unquote made it. I've always been a very ambitious person. So from the word go, I was always making projects, doing things, trying to get people together to put on shows, make a pilot, make a trailer for a pilot, put on a live show, just something. I love doing things. I'm a doer and I'm a writer. And I always, it was never, the question I get a lot is, when did you decide to become a writer? When did you decide to become a novelist? And it was never a conscious decision for me. I just was always a writer. I wrote since I was, you know, a little kid writing the stories in what we call primary school. And it gave me such pleasure and such joy. And I guess I'm a classic overachiever because seeing those A++ pluses on the story were just incredibly motivating. Not sure if I've had a career high as great as my fourth grade teacher putting an A++ on my story. And I, which sort of jettisoned me into a creative life, which is a non-conventional life. I've never really had a 9-to-5 for much longer than shorter stints and really early in my career. And that the path of living, being a freelancer, being a entrepreneur, a creative entrepreneur as it is, you know, kind of forces you out of the mainstream and into a lot of creative solutions, a lot of creative thinking, thinking in ways that other people might not, you know, who sort of do more of a traditional 9-to-5. Mm-hmm. So, but that has definitely always, that wasn't sort of like I was on the straight and narrow and I had that fork in the road moment, as some people do and realize like this life isn't for me, the life over there is, and off I go. Mm-hmm. I think I was always, yep. you know, running around in the other life.
Yeah. And can you give people, I guess, a Cliff's Notes versions, version of that ride?
Yeah, well, the virgin story is probably more interesting, but we'll just go with the virgin for now. Hi, everyone listening. My name is Georgia Clark. I'm Australian, but I live in New York. I moved here in 2009, and I'm a novelist. I've had 6 books published, 2 young adult and 4 adult fiction. And now my lane is queer rom-com. That's what I write. And I also have a live show called Generation Women, where we invite a woman or non-binary performer in their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s to tell an original story on a theme every month at a live show here in New York City, where I live with my wife and my partner, my wife and my baby. And we also have Generation Women shows in Toronto and Sydney and Melbourne, and we're sort of expanding all the time. And I also work as a writing teacher. I teach, I mentor, I teach workshops, which I really enjoy, and, you know, use a lot of my experience in publishing, which has been about 15 years now or so, to inform that. And I love to, I'm a storyteller at my heart. Yeah. That is really what I do in both fiction and the nonfiction space. And I really enjoy performing as well. I enjoy creating community spaces and community events and bringing people together.
Yeah. I really like what you said about on your bio about like you started writing novels. It was way cheaper than film.
Yes. Yeah. I wanted to become a filmmaker in my teen years, in my early 20s. That's what I went to university for. I did a filmmaking degree and studied screenwriting and made short films, poured way too much money into making terrible short films, which is, you know, why all of my friends in Sydney own houses now and I've just got a couple of crap short films up on the internet. But when I moved to the US, I originally came for what I thought was going to be a 3-month sort of creative sabbatical. And I had a plan to write a screenplay. I was going to come to New York, and my project that I was going to undertake when I was here was a screenplay. And pretty quickly after moving here, I sort of got the sense of exactly how competitive that is, how big America is, and how I'd already had a young adult novel published in Australia, a very small book, and I didn't think I was going to kind of do that again. But I had this aha moment, which I think is a really valuable thing to hear for especially kind of up-and-coming creatives, where I realized, oh, what I really want to do here is tell stories, and I want to invent stories in my head and kind of get them out there into the world. And I'd always thought the path for that had to be screen. I mean, you know, I still love television and film. But I had this aha moment of realizing, oh, I could be a novelist. I could, if I was so lucky, and be able to write and tell stories that way. And that's going to scratch that same itch. And as you said, you don't need a cast or a crew or a budget or permits. You play every role as the novelist. You're the costume designer and the editor. You play all the characters, which is actually quite fun. And I sort of realized it was a cheaper And it did, I think, for me, it turned out to be sort of like easier, although there is nothing easy about publishing, way into what I wanted to do, which is tell stories. And so sometimes, you know, we get quite, and I think it's good to be very, you know, you get very fixated on your dreams, you're gunning for something, and that's important. But it's good to kind of keep that like peripheral vision open to sort of know, well, how else would I be able to get there? What other methods or art forms or paths or practices would be able to scratch that same itch? Because, you know, life is twisty-turny and things don't always work out how you want. And there are multiple ways that we can achieve our own dreams, I believe.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I got that when I was, where I was doing a lot of solo show work, and I was like, oh, this is so much money and so much time, and it involves so much. And I get to perform like it three times. I'm like, this is ridiculous. Like, you don't get to do a solo show unless you have a run, at least in the United States. Australia is different. You have the festival circuit. And then I realized, like, doing stand up or doing storytelling, I could do that every night of the week and no one can stop me from doing it. And in order to get good at the thing, you have to do it a lot. And you need it to be like a low investment to just get your practice in. And it's impossible to do that. Like in filmmaking, that's impossible. Like, how do you get good at being a filmmaker? You know, when you wanted to make a good film, you so much is involved.
Oh, yeah. And I have friends who are filmmakers, and it's a slow road, you know. And I really do what I like most, I think, about, and there's a lot of things I write about, like about writing novels. One thing I really like about it is I get to practice it every day or as much as I want to. And I'm not, unlike, you know, if you're a performer, which is, you know, a team sport, and you can't just kind of act on your own in a room by yourself. I suppose you could, but most of you, you're usually part of a production and you're sort of waiting for all these bits to, you know, things to fall into place before that can happen. And the great thing about being a writer is you can just do it anywhere on your own time and, you know, getting paid for it. And, you know, that's a whole nother journey to get to that, you know, getting an agent and getting representation and then getting acquired. But just the practice itself, and the older I've gotten and the more I've, you know, thought very deeply about the arts and creativity and success and what satisfaction feels like, for me, it really used to be about the reception and the outside approval, whether that came in the form of, you know, at first it was getting an agent and then getting books published, and then it's what readers think. And, you know, it's all to do with what's happening outside. And the older I get, the more I feel that that success is something that one must define for oneself in a very personal and intimate way. And it really, for me, it's just about the completion of the work, and what happens after the work is completed is something, a different part of the process, but that's not actually to do with defining the success of it. Of course, I understand that, you know, in a technical sense, yes, if you're a best-selling author, or then that, you know, is successful, but it's been a real kind of a great mind shift for me in my journey to think about the success as being just, well, did I set out to do what I wanted to do? Did I enjoy doing it? Did I have a good time as I was producing this? And if the answer to those questions is yes, then that's a success.
Yeah. Well, how do you deal with, like, because so many things, like, don't you create something, you want to put in the world, and it, you know, whatever happens with it happens. Like, how do you, there is some, though, as hard as you believe in that, disappointment. How do you deal with that?
Well, for me, I've, through bitter experience, I don't read reviews. I don't go to places like Goodreads or Amazon. And I really don't. And everyone in publishing will tell you not to do that. And most writers, you know, you just don't have the self-control, especially at first. Like, you have to go on there and see what people are saying about your book. But those review sites are not created for artists. They're created for the audience. So Goodreads is the biggest review site for readers. And it's, people aren't writing their reviews ever thinking that the author's going to read them, but many authors do go and read them. And it's honestly, it can be absolutely crushing to read a sort of a flippant, dismissive, or worse, angry review of your work. And it can really stay with you and affect your, you know, like your ego and your sort of motivation to write. So I, you know, I where possible, I try and remove reading negative reviews. You know, I tell my readers on Instagram, like, don't tag me in negative reviews. Like, it's just not for me. Like, you're not writing this to hurt my feelings. So, you know, please don't do that. But when disappointments come, which they do, of course they do, that happens as the result of trying. No creative person or person who has had a lot of, you know, success has had just a series of, it's not just one, you know, line going up. It's a roller coaster. It's up and down. And so in those moments of disappointment, feel your feelings. You know, you have to kind of process the emotion, get it out of your body. And the thing that I kind of have, that I really do a lot more these days, is focus on having a very balanced life where possible. I'm a very myopic person. I like mm-hmm. to just spend all of my time. And certainly when I was younger, really it was so much about work, and everything else just kind of was just like, oh, well, yeah, sure, yeah. Friends, family, you know, whatever, blah, blah, blah. And now I feel like I've just had a baby, or my wife had a baby. We have an 18-month-year-old daughter. 18-month daughter, and being a parent has been a real gift for me and a real transition, because it's mm-hmm. something to sort of think about and focus on and get a lot of enjoyment from that isn't anything to do with my career at all. And so having that kind of balance, so that when things are hard, you know, going in there and playing with a stuffed toy with her for 20 minutes, you know, she has no idea about my up as a writer and won't for many years, just because, you know, she won't understand, it's mm-hmm. really helpful. And I just get so much out of it. And just sort of knowing, like, yeah. it's just not the end of the world. The longer you're in your creative career, the more you see that things are just so cyclic. You know, it can be really easy for those first big disappointments to feel like, you know, there can be a lot of extremist self-talk going on, like, that was my one shot, yeah. I blew it, you know, I really wanted to get that thing and it didn't happen, it's never going to happen for me, like, words mm-hmm. are always a never, I'm always going to be this in this situation, it's never going to be like this, yeah. always a never are just not helpful, because they are just exaggerations. And to know that, yeah, this is a down point, this is a disappointment, but you will have, if you keep at it, you will have highs again, and then you're going to have some lows. And it's really just going to keep on going like that. And even if your career is getting better and better and better, you're like, you know, you're becoming a more successful person, an artist, selling more things or whatever, whatever, that kind of roller coaster doesn't actually stop. It kind of just yeah. keeps going, even if the goalposts have shifted completely.
Mm-hmm. And when did you start teaching? At what point in your writing career did you start teaching?
I started teaching about 5 years ago. I used to do in-person teaching before the pandemic. And then during the pandemic, I started to do a lot of virtual teaching. And that's where it really kind of took off, because I suddenly realized, oh, I can, it's not just people who are here in New York City who can come yep. to workshops and things like that. I can now, when I run workshops, I have people from all around the world tuning in, and we, you know, do them virtually. Right. And so I think the pandemic, you know, it was such a complex experience for so many reasons, but one of the changes that happened for me and for, you know, society was this rise in virtual teaching, virtual yeah. anything. And I really enjoy it. It's very fun. It's yeah. very satisfying.
I just had this aha moment recently. I was I did the clown school at Philippe Gallier.
Yeah.
And which is great. I feel like it helps me become a better performer and a writer, actually, too. Yeah. Cuz they're all about few words. So that's couldn't be a better writing reminder. But so I'm there and I'm just talking to a few friends, you know, like, I like to continue to learn. Like, I'm always trying to learn and train and get better and think of new things and ways. And I was like, "Well, then when do you know you're finally like learned like the max so you can teach?" And they're like, "You never, never, like you never stop learning. Like you could like, there's, I'm just like, wait a minute. I don't have to like feel like I'm formed fully, because you're never fully, that's false. That's a false goal.
Right.
You're never fully formed as an artist. You're always changing. It's always changing."
Yeah.
So did you ever have that discussion in your head? Like, how is that for you in terms of like this push and pull?
I 100% agree with you. And because I'm also a practicing artist, like I'm still a writer who is writing as yeah. well as teaching. And I'm still learning. For sure, I'm still learning. And I think that when I, you know, the beginning of my career, I definitely thought, oh, well, by the time I'm pumping books out, you know, there'll be so much more of a smooth experience and it won't take as long and I'll have found all these shortcuts. Mm-hmm. And I'm working on my seventh book right now. And I don't think I've ever done as much revision for a book as I'm doing right now. And part of that is I changed publishers. I changed from Simon & Schuster to Penguin Random House. And I'm working with two editors. And so I'm getting used to two new ways of being with people, two new ways of exchanging ideas. Both of my editors are very passionate and smart and committed, and they have a lot of ideas. And so I'm really feel like I'm still learning so much. And that I think you're so right in that any artist who felt like, oh, I'm done, I've never heard of anyone say that, because you're constantly refining what you want to say or changing what you want to say. Your life experience keeps changing. Yeah. And so your interests keep changing. You get older, you know. I wrote young adult, younger in my, when I was younger. Now I write adult fiction, and who knows what I'll be writing when I'm in my 50s and 60s. I very much hope to be still making things. So, but I know that just from the experience that I've had, I do have things to share and to teach, for especially for pre-published writers, people who haven't published a book yet. I mean, just the practice of having gone through it multiple times with a few different publishers is, you know, and really so much of it as well is there's the craft side of things, which, you know, I still read craft books. I like reading how other teachers talk about things. I feel like every now and again you'll read something that unlocks something and you're like, yeah, that's exactly what it is, you know. Mm-hmm. But my teaching practice, I also talk a lot about psychology and mental health for writers, because writing especially is such a solo intellectual pursuit. I mean, it's just you and the page, and you don't have a team to bounce ideas around or to, I don't know, get any kind of checks with. And so it's, you know, I think that the greatest struggle the writer has is with themselves and the self-talk and, you know, getting to a place where you actually enjoy the work is long and difficult to enjoy the process. Elizabeth Gilbert has a great book called Big Magic, which I think is a must read. And I don't say that about many books for all creatives, because she reframes so many old ideas about writing specifically, and really kind of calls a lot of things into question. And the reframe she has about money, the relationship to money and art, is just invaluable. It really was for me. And I spend a lot of time thinking about those sort of things of how we can become great managers of ourselves, because as the writer, you're both the talent and the manager. You're the person who's producing the work, but you're also the one who is facilitating the environment and the way in which the writing happens. So, you know, when it's going to happen, under what circumstances. And, you know, a good manager is really supportive and realistic and encouraging. And I think a lot of writers at first, we're bad managers of ourselves. We're setting unrealistic goals. We're engaging a lot of negative self-talk. And so learning to become a good manager of yourself, if you want to be an artist, is essential. And something that is another practice outside of the artistic pursuit.
And what about what you said about the financial end of art spoke to you?
Well, and I'm paraphrasing Lizzie here, but the way that she put it, which I think is so helpful, is we often, and I am definitely guilty of this, we get angry at our art for not facilitating our financial dreams, aka I don't own a brownstone in Brooklyn because I didn't sell enough copies of my books, therefore I'm annoyed at my books. They didn't sell enough copies. And her kind of reframe is, your art has nothing to do with money and it's not going to make you money. Like, you have to make money in order to make time and space to create art. So go out there, get a job, get some kind of form of income so that you have the luxury of free time to create your work. That's when the good ideas are going to come to you. That's when you're going to be in a relaxed headspace. And I mean, like, my writing is tied up with my finances because I don't have a day job that kind of pays for everything and I'm writing at night, you know, like, it is all tied in together. But I do try and sort of separate those two things out and not put all the pressure on my books to make money. And honestly, my agent, I have a wonderful literary agent, Allison, and she says that her clients who have the best mental health have day jobs. I think there's it's a very common dream for writers to get to a place where they're just making money off writing. They're a full-time novelist. They're sitting in a lake house somewhere writing books. And I will tell you, I know a lot of novelists, and really most of them have a day job, a significant side hustle. Some have wealthy partners. It is quite rare for a novelist to be making a full-time living, especially in a big city like New York, off books. Mm-hmm. And it is one of those dreams that I sort of tell my students, like, you can absolutely get a book published. Like, that is not, we're not putting a human on the moon here. Like, that is an achievable goal. Making a full-time living from being a writer, that's actually way more difficult. And so, you know, when you're kind of setting your goals, that one might be way down the path. Or if you just are one of those people, they get super lucky and write a bestseller right off the bat.
And the thing, like, I feel like there's so much shame in it too. And the fact of the matter is of like anyone, like any artist I've ever met who's like where I want to be or someone who I admire and or someone I admire a lot is just like, they don't judge. There's no judge. They're not judging. However you have to do it. Like no one's judging you. They don't. And like, especially I find a lot of really great artists, they don't judge even how commercially successful you are. They care not. From what I've seen, because it's just like, what are you making? What are you passionate about? Those are the conversations they want to have with you. Not like, how many books did you sell or how many views did you get? Or like, what are your credits? Like, I don't get those questions. So I feel like there's a lot of shame when people are like, well, I got to, you know, get a day job or I haven't like got these things that I feel like are important. And it's like, that's not actually the important thing. The art is the important thing.
That's right. I think the people that care about like numbers, like that's your team, like that's your editor, your marketing, like they care about those things. But most writers don't really. It's a trap. It can be a real trap to kind of get caught up in those things, because at the end of the day, it is such a privilege to create and we are so lucky to be able to do it. And that in and of itself, if you can just find the joy in creating the work, it will save you so much stress from how the work is received in the world.
Yeah. You're also very creative in your workshops and like how you create workshops and writing experiences. How do you know like which way to go next? Because you offer several things in your writing teaching practice.
I do. I have a romance workshop that I do a few times a year, which is specifically for people who are working on a romance, whether it's a rom-com, a romantic drama. The romance genre is really large and just growing. It's an incredibly popular genre in publishing right now, very successful. I do a workshop where it's 4 to 6 weeks and we workshop a piece of writing, as well as I present craft lectures, you know, a lot about structure, because romance is very structure based, like the way the story unfolds to be a successful love story that, you know, is intriguing and sexy and fun and dramatic. And I do some writers groups where I mentor different levels of writers, some beginning, some more advanced, and we meet once a month for a year. And that's because writing is such a long game. You know, it isn't, you're usually working on a book for several years. And then once you even, you know, if you go into production and you get an offer, you're doing that for years as well. So I think that having that kind of ongoing support, like meeting once a month for you know, a year is writers find it super helpful connecting with each other. And then I host a couple of writers retreats that happen through Generation Women once a year. I've got a workshop on AI coming up. And to be honest, I put the offerings together based on the things that I'm paying attention to that I would sign up for and do if I was, you know, a new writer. When I was a new writer, I did workshops. Some were great and some were terrible. I've done plenty of terrible workshops. And Many of them are not run very well. I didn't feel like I came away with very much at the end of them. Mm-hmm. I just didn't, I really like getting value for money. And so I always pack a lot into my teachings. I always start exactly on time and I finish exactly on time. I'm very type A in that way. And because that's just the way that I like to get things. Like that's the way that I like to be, to receive information, to be treated as someone who is like signed up for something. And so a lot of it is just, you know, paying attention to what am I experiencing that's helping me or that's, you know, that's been helpful. And I think that this is something that new writers would need. I'm perceiving this as a need. So, and, you know, if it speaks to you, sign up. Like most of the stuff is fairly kind of niche and is very helpful for a smaller group of people.
Yeah. Cool. And how did Generation Women come about?
Oh, Generation Women. So I actually did improv for many years in New York City when I first moved. I fell, like, us over sneakers into the improv scene, which at the time was super hot. I moved in 2009 and started taking classes that same year. And I was on an indie improv team from the word go. We were around for about 7 years, called Dreamboat, RIP Dreamboat, still close friends with everyone on it. And it was a very exciting time to be in the comedy scene in New York. And then as I kind of transitioned out of that, I got to a stage where I was on a house team at UCB and everyone around me was like aspiring to be a professional comedian. And I was like, oh, this was just a hobby that got out of control for me. I want to be a novelist. So when it kind of ran its course, I was like, I really want to do another live show because I was on that indie team. We did a live show once a month. But I was like, I don't want to do improv. I want to be able to have kind of notes on stage. And I want it to be more of a theatrical experience. Like indie improv shows are you're in a basement, you're sitting on a milk crate, you paid $5, you're drinking like, you know, a cheap beer, which was so fun. But I was like, no, I want to be in like a theater. I want to have a, and I have sort of like a bit of a background in theater from Australia. I just was always a theater fan. And so that was the idea. And then the idea of doing a storytelling show, because storytelling shows are so popular here, and I'd done some and really enjoyed them. And I was just sort of spitballing the idea with a friend. And I said, well, I just don't want it to be a room full of millennials. Like, I'm a millennial and I love millennials, but I just want it to be more for the community. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, what if there was someone from every decade, and it was, and I just was like Generation Women. And my friend was like, oh, I don't like that name. I'm like, that's the name. So the idea really came from, and at the same time, I was having conversations with my mom, Jane, about the experience of disappearing as an older woman. Mm-hmm. And she told me that the older she got, the more she felt like people were looking right through her. And it wasn't the first time I'd heard that. Like, it wasn't like, what? But it really hit home because it was my mother, my mom, telling me this. And the idea of women being erased from society, which women, you know, the older women from the show will talk about that all the time. Like, it is 100% true that you just sort of start to go through this erasure as an older woman, and it just really annoyed me. And so the community is a true multi-generational community. Like at the show, there'll be people in their 20s and there'll be people in their 70s, mm-hmm. and they'll know that the show is for them. It's not a show where it's really for younger people and it's okay if older people are there. And it's not a show where it's really for older people and we're just going to indulge these like annoying young people. It is truly a show for people of all ages. And I take that very seriously. And, you know, I have no anti-ageist, even jokes, you know, that are in the show. It's a show where you can come and you can feel okay to be your age, which is just a ridiculously rare thing. Yeah. You know, we're for so long we want to be older and then very quickly we feel like we're too old. And I feel like that started for me. Like I heard my friends talking about being too old in our early 20s. And I, even then, something about it was like, well, if we're too old now, we're always going to be too old, you know, unless we change this mindset.
Yeah, I feel like I have a lot of good karma because my friends would be like, oh, whatever, blah, 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 old. And this was at like 25, 26. And I was like, you're ageist. And I'm not talking about people like that. That's because you're going to grow. And now they're freaking out.
Yeah.
And that's, they freak out when they get older.
Yeah. And we need to like be okay with ourselves at any age because we just keep getting older. And so I liked the idea of a show where, you know, and with Generation Women, we have a theme, you know, stories of change or something like that. And we start with Team 20s and we end with Team 70s and seeing how each generation or each decade responds to the theme and what's their concern, what, you know, what their the stakes of their story yep. were. They just get more and more, they, you know, they tend to get like the sort of the lens widens as the show goes on, because in your 20s, you just haven't had as many experiences. Like the biggest thing that's happened to you was maybe a big breakup or moving to New York City.
Yep.
You know, that's the kind of like the biggest thing. So by the time you're in your 70s, you might've had multiple marriages and children yeah. and multiple career changes and multiple like location changes. And you've just lived such a fuller, bigger life.
Yep.
And to really sort of see and understand that older women, older people can be such a source of wisdom, as opposed to how I think a lot of mainstream society thinks it, which is like an annoyance or just yeah. like in the way. And I couldn't agree less with that. And so creating spaces where we can receive that wisdom, I think is, it's so valuable for me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the success of the show is proven that it is valuable for other people as well.
Yeah, that's amazing. And do you want to take this on the road? Is this something you do? It's franchise yeah. kind of like to other, but would you take it on the road?
We've talked about that. We actually had some plans in like early 2020. And then of course, you know, pandemic happened and that all shut down. But I like the idea of doing that. Hit me up, anyone, if you have like a good venue contact or like where we should go, like Chicago, Boston. I work with a great producer, Jessica Laurie, and she's a full-time events producer and she has a big job doing events all around the world. And so she does the show really as a passion project, and I would do it with her if we were to do anything. I don't know. Yeah. She's like, she's busy, but I like that idea. We do franchise the show. So if you just pay a yearly license fee of $750 and then you can get a license for your city and put as many shows on as you want in a year.
Super cool.
And it's a great deal. And you get a, you know, all of our information, all of our IP, you know, we train you up. We tell you everything about how we run the show, and then you get a license. And then you're, you know, go for it. You can put on 4 shows a year. You can put on 40 shows a year. And so that's all that information's on our website,
generationwomen.com. Super cool. Super. Well, and all your, you know, that website, your website, all of your communication is just so clear.
Oh,
it's so like well thought out and logical. And it feels just, I mean, have you like, how do you do it? Like that just, I mean, obviously, because you're a creative writing novels and you have this communication and this structure to what you're offering people. And it's so clear about everything. Yeah, it's unusual to have someone who's good at both. And I think it's so it's really cool to see that.
Yeah. Yeah. I have definitely heard that before. You know, a lot of like writers are great in, you know, their own imaginations and, but that sort of, you know, call it marketing, call it publicity, call it all that front-facing stuff is a different skill. And I don't really know. I'm not an extrovert. I'm an introvert. But I when I'm out with people, I'm, you know, when I do the shows, I'm on, I hang out afterwards, I talk to everyone, you know, mm-hmm. I make myself available. But then I, you know, I go home and I spend the next few nights just like in bed with my wife watching TV. Mm-hmm. So not talking to anyone. But I think when communicating to the outside world as a creative, if you're a creative person, it feels like you're not so good at that. I would say offer something of value. So if you're, say you're doing a newsletter or, you know, because oftentimes we're telling people about our projects that are coming out. We have a book coming out. We have a show coming out. We wrote yeah. a song, whatever. And before, I think people are going to be handing over their hard-earned money to buy that, it helps if they feel like they have a relationship to you, and you build that relationship through mm-hmm. consistent communication. And in that consistent communication, there is things of value. So when I put a newsletter out, I do a monthly newsletter called Heartbeat. I always have a how-to section. That's how to do something. This month it was how to write sex scenes. You know, last month it was like how to revise work. And So I, you know, I have little updates of what me and my family is up to, what I'm reading and what I'm watching. And then I have something that should be really useful. And so creating content that's very useful, and, you know, trying not to ramble, being clear and to the point, understanding where your audience is and going to them, like finding them where they are.
Yep.
And also for writers and for any creatives, like when it comes to any of your publicity marketing, just do the things that you like to do. Don't do the things like if your idea of hell is getting on TikTok, don't get mm-hmm. on TikTok. There are plenty of people that love being on TikTok and that love making TikToks, and like you're going to be kind of like competing with them for eyeballs and you hate it. Like, why waste your time? Yeah. Just don't do it. Do the things that you really enjoy doing. Pick a few things and do those. Do them consistently.
Right.
And, you know, there's no such thing as an overnight success. Everyone works very hard for their shot.
Totally. And how do you, like, in terms of being, because I've heard this before, like, go where your audience is. Like, if you're in an online space, how do you navigate that and figure that out?
Well, you know, my audience for the books is romance readers. So I'm thinking about where they are hanging out online and what kind of forums or places they're in. And when I, you know, experiment with doing a little bit of paid media or advertising, I'm thinking about like where are my people likely to be. And it's a good, I think it's also just a good lesson. My wife has this saying, go where you are celebrated, not tolerated. Yeah. And I see, especially in like younger artists, a lot of anxiety about the haters. And there will always be people like, look, I write romance and I'm always reminded that people make fun of it a lot and that people think it's silly. And honestly, I just do not see that in my bubble. Why would I want to be seeing people on my, like, you know, Instagram feed who are making fun of the thing that I really like doing and gives me a lot of joy and that's also really difficult to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just don't – I know there are people – if I was to seek out people that don't like me and what I'm about, I would find them, you know, easily enough. But that's just – there's just no point in paying much attention to the people that don't like you or making fun of you or think that what you're doing is dumb. Pay attention to the people that are really into it, because we give outsized attention to the negatives, especially when it comes to like receiving things, and the positives, we just neutralize them or ignore them. You know, if someone was to sort of say like, you know, I really loved your book, I'd be like, oh, great, thanks so much. You know, if someone's like, I really hated your book, I'm like, I'm thinking about that for a week now. You know, I want to engage with the people that enjoy my work, and so there's no need, you don't need to have like frenemies or kind of spend time with people that don't really appreciate you or don't really, you know, like value you deep down. Go where you are celebrated.
I love that. Well, I have, so we have a segment called Their Misfit Moment. So the moment where you were like, the real world is not for me. And you just knew that you were not going to live a traditional life. Did you have a moment like that?
I remember, this is like a weirdly embarrassing story, but when I was in my very early 20s, I worked at a publishing company for 3 months to make money to go to Mexico for 3 months with my then girlfriend. I was like 19. It was when I was still at university. And I was a student activist. So I had the blue hair, I had piercings, and I wasn't even conscious of it at the time, but I would walk around that professional office with no shoes on. And the someone walking around Condé Nast with no shoes on. And I like later after I left, like years later, that there was such the talk of the office that there was a girl that worked. I was like a freelance copy editor, like the lowest rung. And I would, I was famous for being the girl with no shoes on. And it didn't even cross my mind at the time. I mean, I was such a little punk and I was kind of like a hippie. And so I guess that was the misfit moment. I dyed my hair pink in high school and then my teacher told me not to. I had to dye it back to blonde. And there was, but just like, I guess So there were sort of some cultural moments where I was defining myself against the norm, and I, you know, I became fairly like radical left-wing activist in my early 20s, and like discovering my sexuality, and you know, yeah. It was a really big kind of like transition of change. And so when I think about being a misfit then, I think about being a misfit now. Those things have, you know, those things have evolved. But I like living outside. I like living outside the 9-to-5. I like working odd hours. I like being able to sort of like take holidays at weird times. Like mm-hmm. I'm really busy right now. We're recording this in August, and August is usually a slow time for people, but I have a revision due of my next book in 2 weeks. So I'm working like really hard. And there's something kind of like fun about being off the balance of the, yeah. you know, the traditional world, the 9-to-5. Like that's kind of where a lot of people that I find interesting operate. And, you know, I'm a bohemian, I guess, at heart, and I love other artists and people that have taken the non-traditional path.
Yeah. Super cool. Yeah. Sometimes I like watch everyone run to work and I'm just like, what's going on? It's fun. Yeah. I get to like kind of observe people from a different vantage point. I find when I see the rest of the world operating according to like other time, like rhythms and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So we also have Misspiration. So in those downs, because there's ups and there's downs, what do you read, listen to, watch? It could be a quote or something simple as that, or something much larger that you use to keep yourself going and in the faith that it's going to get better.
Yeah, that's such a good question. I have sometimes when if I've had like a real blow, I'll watch something really scary because it's the only thing that will sort of like take me out of my own head. I remember like binging all the Scream movies after some tragedy like I went through in my 20s where I think I for some reason was obsessed with thinking I was going to win this competition. I spent a lot of time and money making a trailer for a TV show, and then I didn't even place and I fell apart. I don't do that kind of stuff now. Don't do as many competitions now. Not such a great use of time for me. Competitions are, I think, are a bit of a illusion.
Yep.
But there was a couple of quotes recently that I was thinking about that I think are kind of helpful. And one I just saw on the new season of Only Murders in the Building, which mm-hmm. I'm a big fan of, and it was in the first episode or second episode of season 3. And it's a line where it says that, you know, the best thing about dream chasing is those chasing along with you. And I think I love that because dream chasing is often something that we conceive of as being very solo, mm-hmm. you know, you know, especially for writers, because you are just, you know, you're not in a band and you're not, you know, you're not like in a team. But like, I love other writers. I love hearing about their process and just having a drink with them, you know, and talking shop. And it really is just being part of the writing community is a real blessing for me. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a good thing to be aware of because, especially when you're getting started, there's not a lot of wins. It's a lot of what we would call in Australia hard yakka, hard work. And it's kind of a slog to sort of just get your skill set together that you can write a novel that could be published. I mean, it's really years. Most writers have several unsold manuscripts in their bottom drawer. I have two. Mm-hmm. It took me collectively 2.5 years. But being part, like just enjoying being part of a writer's group, getting to go to a book launch, you know, just getting deep on some nerdy narrative strategy topic with other writers, like that kind of thing can be really fun. And I really enjoy it. And along the same lines, sort of, I like that quote as well about shoot for the moon and you'll land in the stars. You know, I'm always shooting for the moon, and I feel like I haven't got to like my dream right now, which is to become, you know, a New York Times bestselling author. I'll show you this and I will, you know, recite it because it's just above me. I printed out a New York Times paperback, like the paperback trade fiction, and put my new book in at number one for October 27, 2023, which is just like a mocked up thing.
I love it.
which is above my desk, and you know, it's part of my manifestation practice. But even if I don't, you know, get that goal, just the practice of writing and publishing a book that people enjoy, oh, that's pretty good, you know?
Yeah, very good.
Pretty good. So even if you, I feel like if you think like my dream is so out of reach, like my dream is to, you know, sell out Madison Square Garden and I haven't even picked up a guitar, that's okay. You might not sell out Madison Square Garden, but you might sell out your local coffee shop and you might just get a little pleasure from learning to play songs. Like just like talking yourself out of the race before you even get in it, or, you know, just taking a few steps. Like don't do that. Like give it a go and see what happens. See who you meet. Life is so twisty, turny and wonderful. And it's just like putting that first step out there, then that next step out there. And often our dreams are so big, the size of planets. And you're just like, how do I, you know, I want to write a novel and I've never written anything longer than an email. Well, your first step might be to sign up for a course, you know, just take a class or read a craft book or go to a book launch and just see what it's about. And every little step will get you there. And before you know it, you've actually, you know, run a couple miles.
Hell yeah. Hell yeah. I have a question from one of my characters. Her name is Judy. So nice of you to meet you, Georgia. I also live in Brooklyn. I'm the manager of the Park Slope Food Co-op.
I'm aware of the Park Slope.
You might have heard people complain about me. They complain because I make them come to their shift on time.
Oh, okay.
Yes. So I have a lot of ideas. There's so many ideas I could do. The food co-op, there's, you know, we have a limitless amount of vegetables and fruits and cheeses and nuts, and it gives me so many ideas. So many ideas for stories. I think romance, speaking of, there's so many of all the people who come into contact with all this fruit and produce and coming together. You know, we transactional relationships, we meet the delivery men, the farm. It's all waiting there for romance. I feel it. Or maybe I'm just in love with the produce. I don't know. But I can see the storylines, but I feel like I have too many ideas. How do I prune them, so to speak?
Great question, Judy. I get this question a lot. I do some book coaching, and I have a lot of clients who come in with like, I have five ideas, you know, what do I do first? And the thing that I would first say to you is, you know, write them all down, get them down on paper so you can kind of see them in front of you. And then think about which one, if I told you that you only had like a year to live, which one would you feel like that's the one I've got to put out into the world? Or which one just most excites you? Which one's the closest to the things that you read and or watch and consume yourself? I think a great way to think about what sort of, let's say, book to write is look at what you already read. You know, if you already read a lot of domestic thrillers, write a domestic thriller. You are already an expert in the genre. You know what readers are looking for because you're a reader yourself. You know what a cliche is. You know where the genre is right now. So sort of I think your own tastes and your own interests and obsessions are a good place to start. Sometimes we kind of get ideas that are, you know, we think might just be very commercially successful. That's not a good reason to do something. Or we think that we've read like one other book in the genre and we want to give it a go. I feel like you might not really know the genre kind of intimately enough to know what readers are truly looking for. But for me, Judy, the way that I think about it is the idea that won't leave me alone. So the one that just keeps coming back to me, I did a two-book deal with PRH, and so I have to pitch them the second book. I had quite a few different ideas, and the one that I'm going to pitch is the one that I just couldn't stop thinking about, the one that I just kept thinking, oh, this would be fun and that would be good. So I think your own kind of obsession and your own imagination and the way that your own brain turns things over and what it kind of discards and what it kind of holds on to is a good way to start.
All right. Well, look out for a new romance novel about kumquats. Okay.
I'd love it. Yeah. Come right in. Come on. Come on in. We'll work on the title.
All right, we'll work on it. The cum and the quats and the room. It's so much. It's too much for me. Okay, I'm going to go. Whew, getting hot. Okay, bye. Okay.
All right. Well, thank you for hanging out with Judy. She says hi. She's really excited over there. She's drinking some water. She's like,
she's got a lot of good ideas going on.
Yeah. Who knew? So where can people come hang out with you, follow up with you?
Now, my website's georgiaclark.com. So my workshops and book coaching services available through there. And of course, you can buy books and buy if you want to. The best place to buy books is full priced from an independent bookstore. But of course, buy wherever you get your hands on books is how I want you to get your hands on books. There's a new bookstore that just opened up in Brooklyn, here in Brooklyn where I live, called The Rip Bodice, which is the only romance centric bookstore in New York City. There's only one other. They have another one in LA, and that's if you're looking to get a romance novel, explore the genre, head on over to Rip Bodice. And then Generation Women, we're online at generationwomen.us, and we have monthly shows here in New York City as well as a few other places around the world. And you can sign up to our mailing list to be the first to hear about shows. And we also teach a few workshops, and anyone can apply to be a performer. You don't need to have had previous stage experience. You just need to have a desire to tell a story live in front of a captive audience. And we would love to have you on our stage. So
I'm
on Instagram at Georgia Lou Clark, and my monthly author newsletter is at Substack, heartbeat.substack.com.
I love it. Well, we will look out for it. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, there you have it. You can follow the podcast on my page at Lauren Logie. Updates and inside info on my email list, LaurenLogie.com. Thank you to Annie McCutcheon for editing, Edward Silla at Radio Misfits Podcast Network, and Maddie McLennan for making the podcast art. Thanks to our listeners for bringing us back for another season. We'll see you soon.
The proceeding was a presentation of the Radio Misfits Podcast Network. Find our other great shows on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and at RadioMisfits.com. Thank you.